Good morning. Well, that seems, that's a little loud, isn't it? Or is that, good? Okay. How are you all doing?
Tired.
I think when I checked last night around 8-something, the evening, or whenever I posted that message to the discussion forum about you turning your assignments till 8, just before class, there were only about 35 assignments submitted or something, like a third of you. I hope a lot more of you got them submitted. This assignment 5 was not supposed to be that hard. Assignment 4 was a bit of a pain, but assignment 5 was not supposed to be hard. So my plan today was I wanted to go over the solutions now. I'm going to post them after class, but I wanted to discuss them now. I should probably use a projector, shouldn't I? That might be helpful. Let's put that on. Turn off these lights. And lower the screen. Okay, oh good. How about that? So I was thinking of starting with assignment 5, talking about the answers to assignment 5, and then working my way backwards. Let's do that, okay? And then if there's time, I will talk about other topics. So just to be clear, so today is about swapping mechanisms. We're supposed to be a swapping mechanism, swapping policies of XVMS. I'm happy to talk about that after the midterm. So yes. So the midterm covers everything I've talked about in lecture. Which basically is through here, the last time. Now, the amount of material that's covered on the TLBs and smaller tables, don't expect a lot of questions because there isn't much. I didn't ask much about that on the assignments. And the main source of material is the assignments, but I'll probably have like one question on things. What I may do is we'll expand some of the questions that were in the assignment to incorporate things like TLVs, because there were a number of things about address spaces and stuff, and this all fits together in your understanding of virtual to physical address space mappings, hopefully making it more concrete and less abstract. That's kind of my hope. So again, but if when you're studying, so I would say read all the chapters through here. Now note, these chapters actually come later, concurrency chapters, so it's not quite linear if you look at the numbers. But cover all the chapters covered through here. You don't need to, there's not going to be anything on swapping. And the, and then, but when you're focused, you're studying, make sure you understand the assignments. And the associated tutorials, because the tutorials round out the assignments. So let's go to assignment 5. I could try running up these answers up here while I do this without any confusion. So, question 1. Some x86 processors have support for PAE, physical address extension, which allow for the use of more than 4 gigabytes of memory with a 32-bit processor. On a system with PAE, what is the size of pointers used in regular C programs? Why? So first side thing, you notice I said GIB? That's actually not gigabytes, that's gigabytes. You know why I referred to that? You never heard, have you ever seen this GI and KIB instead of KB?
Mm-hmm. Isn't this something to do with one of them being binary and one decimal or something like that?
Exactly. That's exactly the difference. It turns out technically, when you talk about kilobyte and megabyte, the way we traditionally use that in computer science is actually wrong. Because kilo, mega, these are all SI prefixes. They have standard meanings, i.e., you say a kilo something, it means 1,000 times it. So a kilometer is 1,000 meters. But a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes. You know, it's close to 1,000. So, okay, sure, but not. But then we start going to mega, giga, other things. Like, this is whenever you buy hard disks and you look at the storage space allocated to a hard disk. Wow, it says, oh, it's 500 gigabytes. Technically, that's true. But it's 500 gigabytes or a terabyte in base 10. That means it's a gigabyte being megabytes, a million bytes, gigabytes, a billion bytes, terabytes, a trillion bytes. So you buy a terabyte, you're getting a trillion bytes of storage. But if you do that by powers of two, which is what all computer systems want to do everything in, for reasons we've talked about with the way memory is allocated, it turns out file systems are exactly the same way. They want to do everything in powers of two, you get increasingly large differences. So the SI prefix for powers of two, you want to say things like 1,024, mega, 2 to the whatever is, use a GI. That's kibibytes and gigabytes and, yeah, no one ever says it. But that is the notation. So technically, when you have 4 gigs of RAM, you're saying 4 GI. That is technically more correct. Although I can't say I always consistently do that, but that's why I wrote that there. So, you have a system that is running a 32-bit processor and says it has 16 gigs of RAM. You go like, wait, 32 bits can only represent 4 gigs. How does it have 16 gigs? Well, it has P8. So, the question here is really asking, what is the size of the virtual address space and what is the size of the physical address space? So, what's the size of the virtual address space? Yep. 40 bits? 4 right. 4 gigabytes is the maximum virtual address space, so which is 32 bits. That's it. That's the size of your pointer. It does not change. Because if you change the size of pointers, you break all compatibility. Remember, the whole point of saying a 32-bit processor, saying you want 32-bit programs, you know, everything better be the same. If you all of a sudden start changing things around in the pointer drive, then everything breaks. There was a lot of pain when people first started moving things to 64-bit processors and 32-bit processors because they now had to deal with 8-byte pointers instead of 4-byte pointers. Now, what's the size of the physical address space? More than 32 bits. It may be 36 bits, it might be 40 bits, it might be 35. It's something larger. That's what PAE means. You've made the physical address space larger than the virtual address space, which is fundamentally weird. It's a backwards compatibility hack as, the PAE's growth. That's why you want to move to a 64-bit processor, because in general, your virtual address space should be bigger than your physical address space. Space of your imagination, as close to infinite as possible, even if reality causes you to limit things. So this was just kind of a trick. On a system with PAE, what is the size of pointers used in regular C programs? 32 bits, 4 bytes. 32-bit processor, not the size of the virtual address space.
Does that still mean that each process can only still use 4 gigabytes?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. Each process can at most use 4 gigabytes. And in fact, actually, when you say for a lot of systems, when you say a 4 gigabyte virtual address space, a process actually can't access all of it, because oftentimes the kernel says, I'm taking the top gig of RAM, or I'm going to take the top 2 gigs of RAM or something, and I'm going to map that. Some systems you can change how it is, but so it's at most 4 gigabytes. So, number 2, on a system that supports both paging and segmentation, such as the x86 and 32-bit protected mode, you segment based registers hold physical or virtual addresses.
Mm-hmm.
What? Right.
No. Right. Well, this is what you say, first of all, physical or virtual address. So paging refers to, you know, what do we talk about paging? Paging is about transforming a virtual address space to a physical address space. By doing that mapping. Say, you have a virtual address space, I want to map multiple virtual address spaces into the same physical address space, so I do all these mappings of pages and stuff, and I have my page table and have all this magic. Segmentation is about logical divisions in your memory for setting aside code versus data. Let me put it this way. Does your program pay attention during a normal use space program? Does your program pay attention to the way paging works? No. It doesn't know anything about it. It doesn't see it. It's completely invisible. But segments, do you see segments? Yes, there are the segment registers. You set the value. You store addresses in them. You exchange them. Then when you enter a function, you set the base pointer address. You know, you play with the segments on x86 to help with addressing. Given that's the case, is it even possible for the segment registers to contain physical addresses? No. Think of it this way. One way to keep this straight. Which came first? Segmentation or paging? Segments. The reason why segments came first off, you can tell segments came first because they're a heck of a lot simpler to implement. Paging required people. Does segmentation require like these things that store these arbitrary large trees that you walk and you have to CLB in? No, they don't. They just have a base and a bound. Much simpler way of managing memory. Segments were the first attempt to have code that could reside anywhere in physical memory. Paging was the proper solution to having programs reside anywhere in memory. So giving an evolutionary view of computer development, you see that. So you have the old computer on top and the new computer beneath. The new computer emulates the old computer. So segments exist. Yes?
I remember reading the text yesterday that they are segment
Okay, the reason why that's crazy is because let's say it does point to an actual physical memory in a virtual memory system. That virtual address is only valid for 4K. Or 8K. What happens when you get past that value? What I'm saying is the page size. So physical addresses only have validity in page in terms of frames. So you go past. So if it was a physical address, that physical address would only be valid for the size of the page. So that means that your base address range can only address, say, 4K or 8K, whatever your page size. And then once you got past that, it'd be invalid because it's not like the virtual the memory of the program is laid out in contiguous pages. Well, segmentation, yeah, the base and bound, it's just a question of where you put the bound and how big you want.
But that question is
right. Exactly. Now, for example, you can run the x86 in. Now, you'd run the x86, of course, in without virtual memory. So here's the weird thing about an x86 processor, is that it actually has modes for behaving like every Intel processor back to the 8086. Which, you don't know, the 8086 was a 16-bit processor that was first sold in, 1980. That's what every x86 processor could do. It could behave like that. First, that processor came out
35 years old. Yes? Mm-hmm. Oh, and hybridize. Okay. Okay. They did not say that the x86 does hybridize, does it? But the main idea here, I wanted to, the reason why I was talking about this was on systems that support both paging and segmentation. If you're doing segments and you're doing pages, you normally do segments at the level at which the program can access them, not at the level below where the program can access them, because segments are, they're things of semantic value. If you put in physical addresses, it breaks the abstraction. So that's why it kind of like, you can do weird schemes because then it's optimized. And I think I actually looked at that section of the book that says that. I don't know if I missed that, but it just messes everything up if you break that abstraction there. You want, when you have paging, you want it to be just paging, and then you get the virtual address space. It should seem like you control the entire computer. If all of a sudden things leak out about where you are in physical address space, the illusion is broken. And then you're going, okay, now I have to worry about the mapping, I have to worry about the page table, and it gets all bizarre. Now, all of this is kind of, to a first degree, for first approximation, all of this is a bit of a fiction. Because while on older chips, the instructions really correspond to exactly what the processor would do, nowadays it's just an API. The processor does all kinds of tricks behind your back. Like, for example, you think the processor has like 16 registers? No, it has like 512 registers. And it switches between which register to use depending on which process you're running it. You think it's just executing your code one at a time? No, it's actually executing like 10 instructions at a time, going full there, and then throwing away instructions where it turns out it's mispredicted a branch or something. It's crazy. Utterly crazy what they do. But this is what you can do when you have like a billion transistors to deal with. You see the modern, the new iPhone has, they said their systems on a chip has 2 billion transistors. In a phone! So, the level of complexity of modern systems is insane. So that's why anything you learn, like, you have to remember that it's, it's like when you're teaching kids about the solar system. What's the solar system made of? Oh, the solar system's made of the sun. And there's the Earth, and they have this 9 planets. Pluto makes things a little confusing and stuff. But then if you really want to talk about the solar system, there's all the bodies in the asteroid belt, and all the, how many moons does Jupiter have? We're not quite sure, because we keep finding more of them. And there's the Oort cloud with, millions of bodies out there, and stuff. And it's, and the Kuiper belt. And you leave that out. I'm saying it's more than you can handle. But the fact is, it's more than any of us can handle. There's more complexity out there. And mostly it doesn't matter, because it's mostly small bits until you run into one of them. And one runs into you. Then you have to have a more complicated understanding of that particular thing. So when I say I'm simplifying, because I have a simplified view of this, because everyone has a simplified view of this, because no one has the entire picture, because the system's too big. So accept it. So that's what I was trying. So it didn't surprise me that there's systems that have paging and segmentation where they decide to put the physical address in the base register because, yeah, that's another way you could do it. But it's just, what do we do really? We just ignore segments and throw them away in terms of hardware things, and we just, there might be segments from the purpose of the compiler in terms of logically dividing up your program in different areas, but from the processor's point of view, it's just
addressing relative to a register. By the way, when I put together my solutions for assignment 4, I found a nice little primer on x86 assembler, which I put in there. But again, it's not something you need to study for the test. It's something more for you to look at if you are thinking, wait, what all is happening here? So do the stack and data segments of the x86 ever overlap? So a lot of these questions in this assignment were couched in terms of very specific questions about the x86, but they were actually general questions in disguise. So what this question really was saying was, can segments overlap? Yeah, from the processor's point of view. Yes, completely. Because processor has, you know, it doesn't care, first off. And second of all, it's useful. Because when you talk about things like the segment, you know, talking about the stack segment and talking about the, you know, local variable, you know, base segment and stuff, these are, it often makes sense for those to overlap, particularly in dealing with local variables. In fact, that's where you specifically see those registers overlap, is when you're in a function dealing with, okay, I want to access my local variables. Well, we set the base pointer to be a fixed locate. We set the base pointer to be the stack pointer when we enter the function, because the stack's going to change. But this, now we have a fixed location. And that lets us say, well, we're going one way, we find all our arguments to the function, and going the other way, we find all the local variables. And now everything that we refer to can be relative to that value. And we don't have to worry about whether, you know, where we are in memory. So we don't even have to worry about whether the function's been called multiple times. Each time we turn a different part of the stack. Yes?
Shouldn't, like, hardware support?
Does the CPU allocate space? Compiler? So what you're talking about, so remember, when you're thinking, this is why I was saying segments, don't think about paging when you think about segments. If you think about paging while you're thinking about segments, make your head hurt and confuse yourself. When you're dealing with segments, you're in the world of, I control the entire computer, I have one address space that is contiguous, and is everything. That's my world when I'm dealing with segments. When you think of segment registers, now one thing I realize I have made clear is, when you think of segment registers are more like a cache of segments you want to work with right now. That's what they hold. Just like a regular register is a cache of variables you want to work with right now. You want to add X to Y, you load X into register, A, and Y into register B, and then you give instructions, say, add register A to register B, and it's going to be stored in Z. They say save the contents of one of those registers into the location associated with Z. That's how some of those work. So if you want to do operations with segments, what you do is, well, load one segment here and load another segment there, and now we can work with these segments, and those segments pointers change over time? Oh, yes, they change all the time. Just like the values of registers change all the time. So from a compiler point of view, does a compiler want the segments to overlap? In general, no. Because that's really crazy, because these are supposed to have different meanings. But, you know, but here, if you're talking about the specific values in those, the registers refer to, can those overlap? Oh, yes. And if you wanted to, could you, when you're compiling a program, tell it to say, well, I'm going to make this, you know, have a segment be here, another segment here, and have them overlap? You can. You can do that. It's just very confusing. Why would you want to do this? Well, you might want to do things where you generate code on the fly. You generate code on the fly, you could do that to extend your code segment. Do we do self-generating code nowadays? Not normally. Because it's way too confusing. Is that clear?
Okay. We'll have
to answer. Okay. So if you're, I've seen some head shake otherwise, so not clear?
I just don't know how visualize it.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that. So in general, if you're asking, could they overlap? If you were to get the answer, is saying they can't overlap. You then have to make an argument for why the processor would make sure that they never overlap. And you should have realized, wait, why would the processor care? You know, it's just two registers that are there. The reason why you should have seen that these ever overlap is you should have seen assembly language code where you set the value of those two to be exactly the same. When you set them to be the same, then they overlap.
And that happens on standard function. That's how I was expecting you to have seen it, was that you had seen the assembly code and then saw that, yeah, we said it. Like, yes, because you do it every time you enter a function. So this one, I kind of worked it out in class. The way I worked it out, it came out to 14 bits, so 16K. And the way you do that is you go, oh, look, 3, same, so that's bottom 4. A, same, yep. 3, same, so that's 12 bits right there. Then we have C and Z, so what is it? 3A3, 3A3, so this is 0, and this is C. So what's the overlap between 0 and C? Well, what is, so C is actually, that's so 10, 11, 12. Yeah, so it's 12. So if you represent that in binary in 4 bits, that is 1000, correct? Or is it 0100? Oh, right, yes, thank you. Yeah, right. Because 1000 is...
Wait.
No. Oh, yes, you're right, it is. Thank you. Yeah, 1000 is 8. Then 1100 is 12. Which is C. Wait. Yeah, 10, 11, get C. D, E, F, 3 more to get to 15. So you see the bottom 2 bits were the same, zero between 0 and C, so that's why you got 14 bits.
Just get a little practice with binary. Cuts. Yeah. Open that.
The exchange instruction, this is in the book, you Google for it, this is pretty straightforward, this was just, exchange lets you swap the values of two memory locations atomically. Its purpose is to implement things like mutex, locking mechanisms, mutual exclusion, condition variables. Things like that. But when you need a base atomic operation that lets you change the value, that exchange is the one to use. And in fact, if you looked at all that code in the x86 simulator that was in the tutorial, it used exchange. That was how it was implementing the values. It was there right in the programs they gave you. So
under what conditions was
How would you have the compiler produce an exchange instruction from C code?
Yeah, that's...
You don't. If you want to use the exchange instruction, you normally would have to do some sort of thing. Normal C will not translate to exchange. Because you're right, there's no semantic way of saying, I want this to be atomic.
Does C have a keyword? Oh, let's do this as an atomic operation. No. We have a concept for that. So in fact, the normal way you do it in C is you have a function that implements your lock, which has a little bit of inline assembly to do this, and then you just call that function. So yeah, you're right. This is
you can't use this directly from a higher level language, at least not normal ones. So six, Peterson's algorithm.
Does not work reliably on modern machines.
Why?
If you have two threads, you have modern computers have like multiple CPUs, right? So if the two threads are on different CPUs, then they have a different set of registers. For example, that lock is being edited in the register right now. So if one guy does it, the other one doesn't know about it. It's a register right now.
Oh, so you're close, except it's not register. It's memory. Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very significant, because computers have always done work in registers. The idea of Peterson's algorithm is that when CPU1 writes to main memory, CPU2 will see that value immediately when it reads memory. With modern processors, if two cores try to access the same memory location around the same time, you aren't guaranteed to get exactly the same value because it takes time to propagate that information across the cache. And it specifically does not try to synchronize at that level because it reduces performance. Because they both have separate L1 caches. If the value stored in each one's L1 cache, they both have their own local copy that will only synchronize maybe microseconds, milliseconds later to make memory. So that's another good reason. I mean, well, out of order execution also kills this. I wasn't thinking of that, but that's certainly very valid. Because, yeah. Who knows the compiler feeling switching it? Not just the compiler. Oh, well, I think that's that. The reason that, when you talk about out of order execution, modern processors will guarantee that within a single thread, ordering will have the semantics as if they are ordered in the correct way, even if they are executed out of order. It means that if you're looking at what the output of the execution will be exactly the same as if it was executed in order. The processor takes responsibility for making sure that deletion happens, even if it goes ahead and executes instructions 1, 2, 3, then 7, 8, 9, then 4, 5, 6. It's going to look like it executes 1 through 9 exactly. It's going to be different. But that's only a guarantee on a per-core basis. That says nothing about how things will look when you interleave it between multiple cores. So, yes, out of order is execution does that. But the thing I was thinking of was with respect to the memory hierarchy. Is that the memory hierarchy is not completely synchronized between different cores in order to improve performance. And in fact, that's why you have the special instructions, because the special instructions on the exchange do synchronize across the memory hierarchy, and for that reason they are slow. So you don't use them unless you have to. So all this is said, what this was really just trying to say is, wasn't so much I was looking for you to understand exactly the semantics of Peterson's algorithm. I don't care. I once understood how Peterson's algorithm worked, and now I don't really. I've forgotten that. Because it doesn't matter. You can't use it. You can't implement locking between processors purely in software. It doesn't give you the tools. So don't try.
So you take a lock and then you access.
You use the lock to make an explicit access.
Mm-hmm. No, no, no. So
when you grab a log, I see what you're saying is that you lock a data structure. If you get the lock at the, you get the lock before you access your tree or something. You access the tree, and then you unlock it, and then someone else comes along and accesses, tries to grab the lock, goes in there. Okay, fine. Consistent memory was there for the lock, but is the tree somehow not synchronized? Like, could there be old versions of the data in the tree in different places in cache and stuff? No. But the reason why that's the case is because when I say these things that you don't get complete consistency in memory, it's because it's a smidge off. It's a bit off. I mean, there is snooping and things so that it tries to basically keep consistent memory. You're close. And it's certainly close enough when you do things like that. And also it knows whenever you go through a lock and grab a lock, it's going to say, well, let's make sure we synchronize our memory. Because it knows that you're going to be accessing something that someone else has done. So let's make sure we do the synchronization. So that's part of the CPU being a little bit of magic behind the back. But it's the CPU's responsibility to keep at least that level of consistency. And that is not easy. But that's what modern systems do. That's what it means to have an SMP system, symmetric multiprocessor system. When you go to larger systems with larger numbers of cores, you have things called NUMA, which stands for non-uniform memory access. And in those kind of systems, you can have issues like that. So you potentially have to go to more barriers and stuff, depending upon the system. But that's why modern systems in general, you don't bother with shared memory because it causes all these kind of problems. You just send messages. So again, entire classes on parallel systems, distributed systems. I'm just touching on huge areas of work. Much more to learn in other classes. Here I'm just talking about this is a building block. Don't try writing this just in C. If you're going to build a locking primitive for a system, you've got to use some bit of assembly or use a library where someone else did the assembly or a language that gives you built-in support. Spinlux cause programs to loop infinitely until resources become available. High-performance multi-threaded code often uses spin locks rather than locks that yield the processor when waiting for the lock to become available. When are spin locks preferable? So, if you don't spin, basically means wait, just sit there and go in an infinite loop and wait until a lock becomes available, what's the alternative? The alternative is sleeping. So what does sleeping mean? It means that you tell the scheduler, saying, I don't want to run until I'm woken up, until this condition is met. I'm waiting on this thing to happen. Put me to sleep. Wake me up when that condition is met. So the scheduler then said, okay, we're not scheduling you anymore. You're knocked off the run queue. You're now sitting there waiting to run until this event happens. And then when that event happens, you're brought back in, just like if you were waiting for some data to come into the disk. So that whole process of making your process wait and then your process come back, that has an inherent cost. It has cost in terms of you had to invoke the scheduler, you had to run the scheduler, get put to sleep, and run the scheduler. You have to run the sleep system call, you have to schedule to wake yourself back up, you have cache penalties and stuff. I mean, there's all this stuff that has to happen. It's not for free. Yes, context, and it's a context switch. There's lots of things that happen. If it turns out the amount of time you're going to have to wait is smaller than the time it would take to execute all that stuff, don't sleep. Just wait. That's what a spin lock. So if you expect the time of contention to be very small, you're expecting that
whoever's accessing the lock's not going to hold it for very long. It's better for you just to wait around. Well, if you're doing a spin lock, you don't put a timer. Just spin for some number of iterations. Right? It's a while loop. It's out of condition. It'll probably time to do that.
But, yeah, should you be using spin locks very often? In
you don't use spin locks normally from user space. The only time you use spin locks is in the kernel land, normally. Although, well, it's possible for a high for a user space threaded code to use it, but it's not the normal case. Yes? Yes. Because again, it depends. So. For example, something that you might want to put a spin lock around in the kernel might be something like the counter that keeps track of how much time has gone by. And the reason why you might want to do that is because you expect yourself to be, you only want one core to update it at a time, but they're just going to go in there, increment the volume, and get out. Now, if it's truly a small amount of stuff you have to do, well, you can just make it an atomic variable and you don't even have to bother with it. You change the values. Yeah, there's actually all kinds of ways. If you're looking at high performance locks, there's all kinds of mechanisms and some things that will actually spin for a while, and if you spin for a while and if it doesn't you don't get it, then it goes to sleep. And there are hybrid implementations. First approximation, don't worry about it. I just want to know, I just want you to have a conceptual understanding of why you might actually want to loop. And the reason you might actually want to loop to wait for the lock is because sleeping and waking up has a cost. It has a non-trivial cost, and that if you're not going to actually wait for very long, it's not worth it. But how do you know you're not going to wait for very long? You better have a very well, good understanding of the use cases of that particular data structure you're locking. Okay? So then, create dot prod lock free from this code here. All I was expecting you to do for this was you see this... So if you look here, and this is what the work's done in each thread. So it does this, it does this. This is the body of the work. It's looping, looping, looping. But then here, what's it doing? It grabs a lock. It adds it to the sum. It says prints. It does this, and then it unlocks it. Kill this. instead of accessing the dot string sum, what you do is you duplicate this data structure so it's one per thread. You know, you make an array of it, and there's a couple of different ways of doing it, or you could use the return value. But basically, you make this total so that you don't do the adding here. Instead, you do all the adding. Where is it? So here's a number of threads. Do all the adding in the join loop. If you do all the adding in the join loop is when it actually is it's bringing them back in. That's when the threads end. It's like, oh, this thread ended and it came had this return value. This thread ended and this return value. Either use the return values or after that's all done, you access the data structure that has all the values and total them up. Don't lock as you go. That's all. Yep. Mm-hmm. Aha! Anyone to answer that? Yeah. Most of the time it will run fine. Welcome to the world of race conditions. Most of the time it's correct. It seems we do fine, except when it isn't. And that's the problem, and that's why you have these locks, is so that it always gives you the right answer. Because all my programming mostly gives the right answer. It kind of, you know, sometimes it says 2 plus 2 is 4, but sometimes it says 2 plus 2 is 3. Not a big deal, right? 90% right. That's an A. Yep.
When you got rid of the locks, there was a function that was quite similar to create that created four instantiations that ran separately of the parent that you did and kept it on. It's just a separate, but I can't remember what it's called.
I'd have to look at the API to see whether that's correct or not. But that seems much harder. I'll just say that. What? You mean a compare and swap for doing the adding?
Yeah.
And then make sure that you actually added?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could. Basically, what you're doing is trying to implement kind of an atomic increment. Like, actually, if you had declared the value, the integer atomic, it potentially would need locking because you incremented it. It's monotonically increasing value. That's effectively what you would have done there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But part of the point was to avoid contention. I don't want to be synchronizing every time a thread exits. I want to synchronize kind of, you know, just total it up. That was... You'll probably get credit, but... Yeah.
Could you implement a spin lock?
You implemented a spin lock?
Yeah.
No! 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 Well, I mean, it's... Okay. Didn't I say... So the pronoun is doing with, you know, with, or I think I might have added this in later, or any other explicit locking mechanism.
That
if you're doing a
mutex.
What?
That you meant like some sort of mutex.
I meant do not use any locking using mutexes or any other explicit locking mechanism. Notice the name? Lock free. No locks.
It's not really locking,
it's
just a loop.
Yes, it is. It's a spin lock. It's a lock. It's exactly what it is. No. No spinning. The whole point was to say that how do you get it if you don't want... I want to see that you understood the idea of locks by seeing that, yes, you could get away from it and that... That's why you lock, is because this is the benefit you're getting with a lock, is that you can concurrently access the same data structure. If you're not going to concurrently access the same data structure, how do you make things safe? Access different data structures. Okay. So I am at 48 minutes. I'm going to pause here till 9:30. Okay. So I got some feedback on, okay, everyone. So this seems like some of you were reading chapters that I did not assign and got yourself into trouble. So if you talk, in the stuff about advanced page tables, there is this section called hybrid approach, paging and segments. So the key text I want you to note here, so the years ago, the creators of multics, you know, so Dennis had the idea of combining paging and segmentation in order to reduce the memory overhead of page tables. That's what this weird hybrid scheme they're talking about, is they want to use segments to, because page tables, you have to take care of mapping on a per page basis, that's every 4K. If I have a segment, I've got maybe 32K or 128K or something, megabytes maybe, and I can do my mapping there, and then can't I split up my page table based on the logical segments? For modern systems, this is crazy talk. You don't do this because it's crazy confusing, because now you start having segments having physical addresses. This is not how the x86 does it. Do you know when multics was created? Anyone know when multics is? Late 60s. Late 60s, early 70s. It's old.
Now, it turns out Multics is not completely old because, in fact, actually the x86 implements much of what Multics proposed in various pieces. And that's, in fact, why some of the things in the x86 are so darn confusing, because Intel saw, oh, Multics, let's just do that. And they've been paying the price ever since, because some of the stuff they proposed was crazy complicated. And nowadays, much of that functionality is ignored. And in part, one of the things that Multics was all keen about segments, and they did all kinds of crazy things with segments. And nowadays, we don't do much with segments. And in fact, what normally, when you set the base and bound of the segment registers and flatten the flat memory model, which is used most of the time nowadays, the segment size is the entire address space in terms of the bound. It doesn't do these things. It's just, from the processor's perspective, if you're in 64-bit mode, there are no segments. Logically, the compiler still thinks of the world in terms of segments because it divides things up and stuff, but from the processor's point of view, no segments in 64-bit mode. In 32-bit mode, on x86, yes, there's segments, and you still do something a little bit with them, but they're mostly lobotomized. But the key thing to understand is when you're talking about segments on modern systems, the addresses that are referred to in the segment registers are virtual addresses, because otherwise you would expose, because you can manipulate the segment registers. You can see the values of the segment registers. If you can see the values of the segment registers, they do. Now,
I did not know.
There is segmentation that happens. Things get complicated when you really start looking at the processor. I don't think I'm going to ask you about this. It's going to be too confusing. I'm going to ask you a full answer. But how can you access physical memory without a who does the mapping of physical memory? Were you using virtual memory? No. No. No, that's what, when you're talking about virtual memory is not about segments. Virtual memory is about paging, because it's about having a separate address space. You have your virtual, every process has its own virtual address space, which is exclusive to itself. And that's all mapped to the shared resource, which is physical memory. Page table. Paging, TLB. When you had segments before paging, you didn't have virtual addresses. All you had were segment offsets. The poor man's version of a virtual address is a segment offset. Because instead of having this entire elaborate mechanism to map things in very fine grains so they can all go all over the place in memory, you just require a segment to exist in contiguous physical memory. And the purpose of and having the segment base register means you can move it. No, I can have it low memory, high memory, I can move it around as long as it's a contiguous range of memory. It's poor man's virtual memory. It's not virtual memory. Does this make sense? Okay. I'm almost tempted just to say, forget segments. But the trouble is that the textbook covers it and talks about things, and you do see segments. And so, yeah. Yes?
Let's say there's a process that takes, I don't know, five pages. Would you call that a segment?
A process that takes 5 pages, is it a segment?
Just a process with 5 pages?
Yeah, that has nothing.
But what would you call it? 5 pages?
I call them 5 pages.
That's it? There's no name for that?
It's its virtual address space. Okay. Only 5 pages, that's pretty small. But a book? It's a pamphlet. This is one reason I've talked about the evolutionary approach to understanding computer systems is because there's all this baggage Segments came first. They were a way of mapping programs into arbitrary parts of memory. It wasn't flexible enough. So we created a more flexible system. The more flexible system is virtual memory. Virtual memory is very complicated. But it makes the life of regular programmers much easier. But because you might have programs that still use segment mechanisms, you have systems that have virtual memory that have a segmentation model on top to provide compatibility. The x86 processors had to do this because older versions of the processor only supported segmentation. Virtual memory, there's the 8086, there's the 80286, there's the 80386. The 80386 was the first one to actually support virtual memory. So what did 8086 and 80286 do to have the programs consistent with parts of memory? They had segments. So now you have a 80386, you want to run a program, but it was designed for the 80286, so the 8086. What does it do? It wants segments. So what does the 8086 do? It says, let me run this. I'll have some support for segments. But they have to be on top. And it turns out the ways in which it emulates past stuff is very confusing. There's actually these modes that the 80386 can run, little virtual 8086s. You have them run separately. Most of that is just history. AMD helped us there. You'll know about the x86-64, that AMD is the one who actually invented that. So there was this whole thing with the x86 is an old architecture with lots of messiness. So Intel came up with the 80386, 80486, came up with the Pentium, and all these iterations of the processor. But then they said, this is the 32-bit stuff. How are we going to go to 64-bit? And they said, we're going to start over. And so they created something called Itanium. This is the IA64 architecture. So it was using all kinds of new ideas for making a new instruction set completely different, completely broke compatibility, and it flopped. It flopped in the marketplace. People hated it. It was a pain to compile for. It was bad. In the meantime, AMD said, I think we can make this thing 64-bit. So they proposed a 64-bit version of the x86 architecture called x86-64. And they loved it. So AMD produced this, and lots of processors came along, and then Intel said, and they adopted it. And they cleaned up. AMD did a good job of cleaning things up, much better than Intel did. So actually, x86-64 is not half bad because it was designed by people who are sane and not obsessed with backwards compatibility. Intel was trying not to be obsessed with backwards compatibility, but they jumped the shark and just threw it all out and tried to have everyone rewrite their programs for a new processor. Yeah. So going back here, let's talk about other assignments. So I haven't actually uploaded the annotated assembly code yet for this program. I lost time. I'm going to upload it, I think, by tomorrow and stuff, but don't worry about it too much. I'm not going to ask you stuff that level of detail. The reason I didn't annotate, because I realized I started annotating the optimized version of the code, and I realized the way I had written my program, I had written it with these separate functions. So you'll notice I actually implemented string copy and string length. I said you couldn't use libraries. I didn't say you couldn't get code from the net. So this is actually library code from OpenBSD, which is their version. I mean, you could write this yourself. There's no reason not to write this yourself if you want to write your own string copy. It's not a long function. But I said, this is the canonical ones. So this is string copy string length from OpenBSD. And so since I included from OpenBSD, I included their license. That's what all this text here. Most of the text here is license. For these, the license is longer than the code. But this is
So here, that's that code. So I did that. I brought in string copy, string length, because it meant I could then do these sort of things right here. But here's the funny thing. I've got all these function calls here, and if I actually look at the optimized compiled version of this code, main has no function calls. It has a system call. It has my system call, but it has no function calls. You're going like, why doesn't it have any function calls? Because this code is so simple, it just inlined it. It just stuck it right in there. Did any of you have this experience when you wrote you compile it without optimization, then you see, but then it gets much more verbose. But yeah, so I started annotating it, and then I annotated these, and I got those there, and then I got here, I was like, crap, this is all optimized. How am I going to explain how? I mean, I can show you where the functions are, but it's done some pretty impressive work with combining the code, which is great for making efficient code, but not so good if you're trying to explain what every assembly language line does. So I'll put that up, but the purpose of this was more to give for you to do the exercise. Now, the one thing that for question three on this assignment, question three was write a program that outputs "Hello, I am process 417." So what I was hoping for you to do was, well, you had to do a get PID call. So that's this. I didn't figure that would be that hard for you to figure out, given what I had shown you. But then you had to insert it into the string. This is actually the hard way of doing it. The easy way of doing this was actually to do to do syswrite three times. I did the hard way here because it just offended me to do three system calls for something that I could do with one system call. But you could have done syswrite for the beginning part of the string and syswrite for the thing, for the number, and then syswrite for the end. Then the other hard part was just doing the conversion here. This is where I did the conversion. And the way I did the conversion was I first did it in reverse order and then I reversed it. That was laziness. You could have actually written it backwards and had a pointer at the beginning of it. Yep. But the trouble is you still have to convert the process ID number into a string. You still had to do this. So what was the real purpose of this? To make you appreciate libraries. And this should also make you realize that all that work, you go like, wow, we can make all these fancy programs. Why couldn't people back in the past make all these fancy programs? Because they were busy having to do stuff like this. So the other things that you should look at is, what's the difference between function calls and library calls? This you should know. When I say a library call, what am I talking about? As outputted by ltrace. What does ltrace do? It shows the function calls to functions that have been dynamically linked. Which means that they are having to go through, they're being called indirectly, because exactly what the address is of the function is not known at compile time. That's what it means to do dynamic linking. The address has to be resolved when the program is loaded into memory, because you don't know where the library is going to be loaded. So it has to use a variety of indirection mechanisms to call it. Ltrace messes with that linking so that it can keep track of where, when you're calling those. Other function calls that are statically linked, i.e. functions that are known, their location is known at compile time, those will not show up in ltrace. Because the compiler actually did a direct call to that routine. It's not using an indirection that can be intercepted. So when I say library call here, the library calls are to functions that were dynamically linked into the process. Function calls in general could have been dynamically linked or could have been statically linked. If they're statically linked, they wouldn't be reported. That's why ltrace gives an error when you statically link the executable. And then, so C semantics assimilates. I gave you a summary here. Caller saves things, but the full story is actually this. Actually, I was very nice to see this. You go to like section 6 here. It walks you through the exact calling convention, which is so. Like for example, here, here's what the caller should do. Here's where to do the registers. Here's what the callee is supposed to do. Goes through a nice detail. If you want to understand what exactly is going on, this is good. The main thing I expect you to understand is the idea that the caller pushes the argument onto the stack. You call the function. The function allocates based on the stack for local variables. So on the stack is local variables, the return address, and the arguments of the function. I did not finish it yet. I've got to finish it today. Certainly, I have to finish it before I leave town tomorrow. But the midterm is just going to be these questions with a few extras with these questions edited, short answer. I don't think I'm going to even do any more. Sometimes I think it's some multiple choice, some fill in the blank, but I think that would actually make things harder. So it's going to be short answer. Unless you really want multiple choice. Do you want multiple choice?
Yeah.
You really don't. Trust me, you don't want my multiple choice. Yes?
I heard back about that earlier meeting for the
interview. Is that quick question. How many of you are interested? We've gotten 7 names. I'll email you. How many of you are interested in the earlier seeing for the midterm? The earlier one. The one on Tuesday afternoon at 1. I got 7 names. Do we have eight now? Okay. Oh, this weekend we should set up conference and email to say. But listen, it turns out so few of you have decided to come, and we have a room back at home like 50. If you want to come on Tuesday afternoon, just show up. Okay? Just go ahead and show up. It'll actually make life easier. The more of you that show up on Tuesday, it'll actually make our life easier because we can't actually have all of you take the midterm in this room on Wednesday. We actually have a second room upstairs here allocated on Wednesday simply because if we have everyone here, you're too tightly packed in. So more of you that take a Tuesday is better, but so just go ahead and show up. The Tuesday one? Oh, right. Well, I'll post that. Yes? What, huh? On the 21st, it's at... the 21st is Wednesday? Wait, is it Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday.
On the Tuesday one, it's 1 o'clock. If you take it Tuesday, you do not need to show up on Wednesday. No. You take it. Yes. I will post it to the You're not gonna. You'll be reading code. I'm gonna put it as. I've gotta give you at least one. I've given you made you work this hard in assembly. I've gotta give you at least one little snippet of assembly and tell me what that. But it'll be easy.
The tutorial is today and I guess.
Oh, yes. So the tutorial today and Monday is review, which means show up and ask questions. You know, the TAs will keep track of who shows up, but I can't in good conscience call this a required tutorial. I know you all have to allocate your time and try to figure out what your priorities are and stuff like that, so that's perfectly fine. But come to the tutorial, you know, it doesn't matter which one you're assigned to. Show up Friday or Monday, and TAs will be there to discuss things. Okay? Anything else?
There's no work assigned in the
tutorial. No work's assigned in the tutorial. Wait, you really want more work?
Review work.
You've got the tutorials in this. I mean, if you've got questions for something that's not clear. So, see you.